Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and became a high school English teacher. He became a basketball coach at the high school, college, and pro level. In 1983, he became the coach of the Detroit Pistons, a club that had never recorded back-to-back winning seasons, and he led Detroit to 9 straight winning seasons and back-to-back NBA championships in 1989 and 90. His name? Daddy Rich. Chuck Daly. And I'm Jack Krasula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything is Possible with Jack Krasula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're talking to Daddy Rich, Chuck Daly. Chuck, welcome. It's an honor to have you.
Thank you, Jack. Nice to be here.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your parents?
Well, I had one of those, you know, childhoods that were legendary and things you dream about. Small town athletics, perfect parents, church, school, a town of 5,000 people. And it was a very comfortable existence. And we didn't have a lot of money, but in those days, most people didn't. And you you ate pretty much the same as everyone in town, and you had basically the same clothes. You played on the same teams. You went to the school dances. So, you know, it was a pretty level society, quite frankly, at that time, and a very, very easygoing childhood.
What did your dad do?
My dad was a traveling salesman for Miles Kane, which was produce and canned goods. In those days, they had to go on the road to towns 25 to 50 miles away, and he had a regular weekly route that he took, and on occasion I would go with him. I remember particularly going to Corry and stay over, Corry, Pennsylvania, stay overnight, listening to the radio and hearing about Joe DiMaggio trying to extend his batting streak at the time. And I've got a lot of autographs, most of which, a lot of I didn't ask for from people. It would have been very profitable today. But I do have one from Joe DiMaggio that I got years and years later that I kind of look at every day. And I kind of enjoy that because he was one guy I particularly admired.
What's the biggest things you learned from your mom and your dad?
Well, my mother was a very church-going person. She was Protestant by religion. My father was a Catholic. I was raised as a Catholic. But she went to all churches. She would go to the synagogue. She would go to the Catholic church. She would go to the Protestant church. And she was a very fine woman, a real lady, caring about everyone, animals. I was raised in the 30s, which is a very tough time for this country. And we had guys that couldn't work, and they were on catching railroad cars, and they'd come to your back door. She'd feed them, even though we didn't have a heck of a lot, but she was that kind of person. My father was a sharp guy. He was one of 7 brothers who were in the service, World War I, at the same time. By the way, their pictures were on the cover of the New York Times, and many of them were injured or killed, but he survived, and he was a vocalist, a dancer, a baseball player, and a very sharp dresser, kind of a bon vivant type of guy, quite frankly, for that era.
Where did you go to college, and what sports did you play?
Well, I played all sports in high school. I was a high jumper in track. I was a quarterback in football, and I was an inside player. 6'2" in those days was a big player, could play forward, even center. And I got a scholarship to St. Bonaventure in New York, and at that time they still had football, by the way. And it was a time when a lot of people were coming back from the service, so I was involved with a lot of older guys. And at that time, St. Bonnie's was involved with Canisius and Niagara in the Buffalo Odd, and it would be the Big East of today. Games were televised, sold out, tremendous rivalry. So I went there as a freshman basketball player and received a scholarship to Bonnie's, and interesting experience.
You get out of college, you get a job in high school. Where at? What did you do, and how much did they pay you?
Well, I was I knew that I wanted to coach, and everybody who wanted to coach was taking phys ed, but I decided to take speech correction because I figured there weren't many people taking those courses, and you'd probably get a coaching job easier. And as it turned out, that's exactly what happened. I'd gotten out of the service in 54, U.S. Army, and I was looking for a teaching coaching job, and this job came available at Punxsutawney High School, the famous Groundhog City. And I went in for an interview, and there were two of us that were finalists. And the one guy, they said, would you be an assistant? And they asked both of us the same question. They asked me if I'd be an assistant, and I said, no, I want to be head coach, even though I'd had no experience. And I ended up getting the job for $3,600 a year, teaching English, speech correction for the district, coaching basketball and golf.
How did you go from high school coaching to the college level?
Well, I had been in Punxsutawney for quite a few years, having a hard time getting out of there, moving up the job ladder. And I had applied at many, many places and couldn't get anything concrete. And all of a sudden, I had a young man who was a manager at Duke. His father was a lawyer and had his own plane in those days. Probably was a Piper Cub. And we flew down, and I met the staff down there one time. And a peculiar thing happened. Duke was in the finals, in the Final Four in Louisville, and they asked me if I could fly there and go with them, which I decided to do. And then I got a scalper's ticket. I was in the last row, watched the whole process, and thought, boy, this is wonderful. This would be great to get into college. Later on that year, a job came open there. I applied by letter, ended up getting the job. So I went, and that year we went to the NCAA Final Four in Kansas City. So I went from a scalper's ticket in the back row to the finals in 1 year.
We're talking to Chuck Daly, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760. WJR.
This is Anything is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR with Jack Crisula.
Welcome back. We're talking to Chuck Daly, who the Pistons retired jersey number 2 for Chuck Daly, representing the two NBA championships.
Correct. I thought it was going to be two suits, but it turned out, because that's about all I had, really. Everybody thought I could dress, but I really, really only, that's kind of a joke among myself and Matt Dobek, who's the PR director. One time Sports Illustrated was doing an article on the clothing, not the coaching. And we were up at Cousins, famous Cousins, and which I had a great relationship with. And so the guy's writer said, you know, how many suits, Matt, does he really have? 100? And Matt looked at him with a wry smile and said, you mean 100 blues, don't you?
How did you ever get the nickname Daddy Rich?
Actually, I think it was kind of John Sally, who kind of knew that I was not making big money here. Any of the years that I was here, I was not making the kind of money that they're making now or anywhere near it. In fact, I came here, I think, for $125 a year, and you take taxes out of it, and, you know, it wasn't a lot of money, but that's what they were paying coaches at the time. So I used to dress pretty good. I had pretty good shoes. They were always shined. And, you know, there's an old theory about Irishmen. Irishmen, you know, they walk around with a shine on their shoes. And a lot of mothers, in fact, my wife's mother said, you better check the bottom to see if there are any holes in them, because Irishmen, they shine their shoes, but there's a lot of holes in them. So I guess John kind of knew that. And I always looked like I had money, so he called me Daddy Rich, and it kind of stuck for a long time.
What is the biggest difference between coaching college basketball players and NBA basketball players?
Well, all through the years, it's changed dramatically. You know, it was a little bit like, how do you coach high school kids, and how about college kids? And there wasn't a big separation. But as the NBA advanced and started to pay huge, huge money, and we know the kind of contracts, Ben Wallace is seeking a contract, I don't know exactly what it is, but between $70 and $90 million. And so this kind of changed the landscape, I think, of coaching and the way you coach. First of all, collegiately, when I was coaching, people stayed for their careers and graduated. Hopefully they graduated, and most of them did. The schools that I was involved with, Duke, Boston College, Penn, people graduated. They went the full 4 years. But then things changed when players were allowed to get into the league a little bit earlier. And so consequently, you start dealing with corporations. These kids were innocent basketball players playing for the love of the game. But now, quite frankly, it's called out. These players are called out 11 or 12 years old. I'll give you an example. About 3 to 4 years ago, I was checking in a hotel, Fairmont, an expensive hotel in Chicago. And as I'm checking in, I'm looking around the lobby, and I see a bunch of kids, and I find out later they're from Houston AAU team. They're 10, 11, 12 years old, checking in to the Fairmont. And then I started to realize that they were being called out because of their talent and, you know, getting them ready for their career. And there are a lot of people involved in that, agents, other people who are looking for, you know, side money and issues of other kinds. And then we had the big surge where so many kids left college early. Now they leave high school, or were leaving high school until last year. They put in an age situation. It only added up to about a year, 19 years old. And a lot of people wanted it to be 2 years, 20 years, so they could spend a couple of years in college. But, you know, the right to work and all of the legal issues of it just couldn't be done. And so they got 1 year. So when you were dealing with the people I was dealing with originally, you were dealing with young kids who were thinking about going to college, getting an education, and playing basketball. And quite frankly, that changed when high school kids could go to the NBA and make a ton of money, and then collegiate kids could leave after 1 or 2 years. And so, you know, it's turned into a heck of a problem for the college. Tom Izzo just lost a player the other day, and a lot of college coaches, when they recruit now, they know that the great players that they're going to get might be only with them 1 or 2 years. So it went from dealing to young kids wanting an education, basically, to people who became, you know, you're coaching, or you're dealing with people who are CEOs of their own company.
You coached at the college level for 14 years, and then you made the jump to the pros. How did that jump happen?
Well, I was at Penn, and I'd been there for, I think, 6 years. And I had a couple offers to go to other collegiate situations, and I didn't move. I had one or two guys who wanted me to come to the pros and be an assistant coach, and I rejected that. And then I got to the point where I said, you know what, I just need to move on for my own sake and everybody else's sake. I was kind of bored with coaching in the Ivy League, doing those weekend things and facing Pete Carril every year to go to the NCAA championship. And I had a friend who I'd met, Billy Cunningham, and one night we were out celebrating a top broadcaster was going to Chicago, and he did all of the games in Philadelphia on the Big Five, which at that time nobody was doing TV of college games, or rare, and we were doing all of the games. It was way ahead of its time. And he said, what are you doing later? I'll meet you out at City Line Avenue at this place. And I said, sure. And when I'm out there, he said, would you be interested in going to the pros? And it was in November. We were about ready to start practice, and I didn't know if I was going to be able to get released. And I said, yeah, I'd be interested. And about 3-4 days later, Pat Williams, the heralded Pat Williams, who's now done 18 books, called me and said, would you be interested? And I said, definitely. And I went to the athletic director. He freed me up to go. We had a very good team that went to the Final Four a year or two later. And I ended up going with Billy Cunningham of the 76ers, and that kind of started my career in the professional ranks.
You were the head coach at Cleveland for a couple years, but then in 83, you come to the Pistons. The two previous years, we had won 35 games only and then 36 games. And you turned the thing around. How did you change the culture of the Pistons?
Well, you know, I was looking for a head job. I had taken one in Cleveland, quite frankly. We kind of glossed over that. But I was there roughly 93 days because I went there knowing that it was a very tough situation. And basically, we agreed to leave each other after 93 days. However, it came out as a firing. So I lived in Holiday Inn there, and I coached for 93 days, and I went back, and I did TV for Philadelphia for a year or two. And I had rejected the Detroit job prior to that. I had been assistant. I'd come up here and met with a number of people, and they weren't paying me as much as I was going to make as an assistant there, so I declined the job. Now I'm out of coaching and doing broadcasting and very happy in it. And Jack McCluskey called and ended up taking the job here for $125,000, not $3 million or whatever these guys happen to be getting here, but took the job. And I looked at the personnel, and I thought there were decent personnel offensively. Jack was more interested in the defensive side of it, but I was interested in the job. And I said, I'm going to take the job. And I didn't do anything dramatic. I didn't give any speeches. I just decided to put in what I thought it took to win basketball games. In other words, offensively and defensively, and continually talk about winning and what I thought was winning basketball, which had served me well, by the way, throughout my career, which I want to get to, because I was watching Charlie Rose with Larry King this week. And interestingly enough, I'd been on Charlie Rose's and Larry King's show, but I'd been on Charlie Rose's show several times. And one night I was here in Detroit about four years ago, when Rick Carlisle was the coach. And a guy by the name of Jim Collins came on, who did a book, Good to Great, which is a very famous book. And I read the book, and I listened to him, and I called Rick, and I called a number of other my friends in coaching. I said, you have to read this book, because it basically applies to coaching. And I won't get into the theory of the book. We'll let the audience decide if they want to read it or not. After I talked about that, I did a number of clinics, and I brought up this book and tied it into coaching, the business side of it. But after I reflected several years later after that, I really realized why, in my own lucky way, I had had some success in coaching. And it was for the same reason that these great companies became great companies, because there were certain things I believed in basketball that applied to winning. And I never gave up those philosophies from job to job, from level to level. And quite frankly, those are what help you win basketball games. And these are the kind of things that I did when I came here.
We're talking to Chuck Daly, and I'm Jack Crisula. And this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
Now back to Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
We're with Chuck Daly, who was a head coach in the NBA for 14 years. Chuck, you had a lot of great moments with the Pistons. What's the most memorable?
I don't know if you can really say one moment. When you win two championships and the previous year go to the final 10 seconds, I guess it would be the first win, although it almost became relief at that point. When you go through an NBA season and you go through to the championship, you start basically October 1st, and that was on June 23rd. You practice, play, or travel every single day. There basically are no weekends off like any other normal person. And, you know, you're in a hotel and somebody going out to dinner on the weekend, and you don't think about that because of the way the schedule is. And I guess it was almost relief and kind of validation for your coaching career, is what it amounted to. And then, quite frankly, because I've coached a lot of different teams, collegiately, high school, other professional teams, you come to a juncture with the team where the personnel is there to win a championship. And that was developed through Jack McCluskey and myself over a period of years. And we had some rough sledding over that. But you have to have, you're not going to win a championship. You're not going to be validated unless you have personnel. And any coach that thinks any differently is just kidding himself.
You won 638 regular season games, and you lost 437, and you're in the Basketball Hall of Fame as a Hall of Fame coach. How did you learn to handle defeat?
One of the hardest things that I think you have to do, and it's one of the hardest things. In fact, I talk to a lot of pro coaches. I have two or three or four really close friends on the professional level. And one of the things I brought up prior to last season to a couple of them was said, how are you handling defeats? Because you, as the coach, must handle it. You've got to move on. You've got to take the same 12 guys that lost tonight. Tomorrow, you probably have got to play again with the same 12 guys. So you better be very careful how you handle yourself and how you handle the loss and the sensitivity of it. A lot of players get so upset that they want to point fingers. You can't do that. You can't take them on every night. So you have to learn how to deal with that and how to teach them to deal with it to move on to the next night, because you need a win in order to keep your job if you're going to coach them.
We're talking to Chuck Daly, who was the head coach of the original Dream Team in the summer of 92. We'll talk to him about that when we come back. I'm Jack Krasula. This is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Once again, here's your host, Jack Krasula.
We're talking to Chuck Daly. Chuck, summer of 92, the original Dream Team, greatest team ever. You were the head coach. Can you tell us about that?
Well, it's a long story. In fact, I did a book, a diary, day by day. It was done by Turner Publishing. Actually, it was so well done pictorially that people thought it was a picture book and don't realize it was a diary. Now there are none in publication. You can't get one if you want to. And probably you could probably buy it for about 80 cents if you could find it. But at any rate, we did a book. And it was one of those experiences that originally I rejected. Billy Cunningham, my old mentor, friend of mine personally, who I play golf with about every other day now down in Florida, but he called me and asked me if I'd be interested in the job. I said, no, I'll be, it was 3 years away, and I said, I'll be too old. Let some of those young guys do it. I'm fine. Plus, I'm going to the finals every year. I'm worn out. Blah, 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 you know, what Larry went through. And so, Larry Brown. And so, ultimately, it came down to a situation where I ultimately got the job, and I was more than shocked. And then I started to really think about the ramifications of the job. And quite frankly, this past fall, Mike Krzyzewski, the famous Duke coach, was named to the new USA head coaching job, which he's going to take on for the next Olympics. So he had me on his radio show. And the first question that he asked me, I answered. Then I asked him a question. I said, can you divide 12 into 40? And there was a silence on the other end. Because what you have to do is take perhaps the best 12 basketball players on the planet and divide up their playing time into 40 minutes, not 48 like an NBA game. And that was the thing that for a year I fretted about, because I thought, how am I going to resolve the problem of keeping Karl Malone, Michael Jordan, Charles Barkley on the bench? And so that's one of the big problems that you face. But it was an incredible, incredible experience. And we had to qualify in Portland. We trained in La Jolla. And there were about 6,000 journalists following us from around the world. My telephone in the room I had, or suite, or whatever I happened to have, never was not full. And I could never pick up the phone without getting more messages. So, frankly, it was a long, tough 7 weeks, but, you know, a little bit like traveling with the Beatles, I would say, because of all the things that happened.
The 12 of them rented a hotel in Barcelona. And what did you do every day with them?
Well, frankly, we went over the year before to look for places to stay, and we couldn't find in Barcelona exactly what we wanted. So, in essence, I think USA Basketball and maybe the NBA, I don't know if they bought the hotel, but it was a brand-new hotel that we moved into when we went there. It was down a little side street, kind of isolated. And so we moved into this this hotel that had guards out front with Uzis on their chest, a guard up on top with an Uzi, and everywhere we went in the bus, because we were a Tom Clancy novel waiting to happen when you think about it. The Basque, I think, had killed 8 people in Barcelona that year, including the police chief. So there was an incredible amount of security going on. We never went with the traffic. We went against the traffic. We had two motorcycles in back, two in front, one on the side, two police cars following. So it was quite an experience. In fact, it was so interesting that nobody could get near the hotel. So one day I had a call from Lee Iacocca, who was staying across the street and wanted to have a drink. And Lenny Wilkins, who was with me as my associate, we went across and met Lee, and it was kind of interesting. But it was very highly securitized, if there is such a word. There was a lot of pressure in terms of winning the championship and, you know, handling all of the timing of these individuals, all of who were great, great players, got to be real interesting.
Who was the leader of that team, and how often did you golf while you were in Barcelona?
Well, leadership was interesting. I named Larry Bird and Magic Johnson as co-captains. But outside of the room for our initial meeting, in which I had a square table, which no one was going to rise up above. If you had anything to say, it was going to be seated. And I asked Michael outside, I said, do you have any interest in being part of this triumvirate? Because I knew who Michael Jordan was and what he meant to the basketball world. He said, now let the old guys do it. And so he was great. And so we started from that standpoint. And I made a couple decisions myself. One, I was going to start a different team every night, and I was never going to call a timeout because we played at 10:30 at night, and I wanted to get them back so they could eat. Which turned out to be a very dumb decision on my part because I lost so much airtime commercial-wise, it was pretty stupid. But nevertheless, we fulfilled all that. We filled the days mostly because we never practiced. Playing every other night, I didn't think it was necessary. We did practice one time. We went to a gym up in the other part of Barcelona where it was 90 degrees, no air conditioning in the gym, and that's one of the reasons I didn't practice. And Clyde Drexler came with two left shoes, didn't tell anybody, and practiced with him because he was embarrassed. But I think Charles Barkley probably had as much to do with the leadership of that team because he was so gung-ho. When we would leave the locker room, he would raise his fist, and he was very decided about what we needed to do. Along with that, we played a lot of golf, a lot of golf.
Jordan bets every shot, every hole. Did you ever beat him?
Well, Michael is an interesting golfer. He likes the challenge of the game and the dollar, and he really was confident in his game. And we would go out to a course right near the airport. I've gotten a reel or something that for it. And we went out, and he would pretty much have a wager with everybody on the course, including the Spanish national playing and all of our guys. Well, one particular day, I happened to play pretty well, shot 78, and collected a bet from him. I had paid him a number of bets, but collected on that particular day and didn't think much about it. The next year, I had moved to New Jersey and was coaching the Nets, and frankly, he was killing us. He's in the range of 50 points. We couldn't stop him. Finally, he ran by the bench, and he said to me, "Don't ever beat me again in golf." Which tells you a little bit about his competitiveness. But it was a great, great experience and one of those lifetime things.
Was he the best you ever saw?
He was, if he wasn't, I don't know who was better because Isaiah Thomas, had he been 5 inches taller, he might have been the greatest. Joe Dumars, a lot of great players, but quite frankly, he was pretty special.
We're talking to Chuck Daly, and I'm Jack Crisula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR.
You're listening to Anything Is Possible with Jack Crisula, sponsored by Trust in Us on News Talk 760 WJR.
Welcome back. We're with Chuck Daly, who was inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame in 1994. Chuck, what makes a great coach?
Well, there's a lot. I've been thinking a lot about that. I was even thinking about doing a little bit of book about it or a guide because I get a lot of calls. I do a lot of speaking along that subject about building teams and coaching. Now, I don't think you kid yourself. You're only going to be as good a coach as your personnel. However, having a great personnel or having good personnel basically isn't enough. I think you really have to know your subject. And when I say know your subject, I'm talking inside and out. In basketball or in all sports, you have to know both sides of the ball. You've got to understand the offensive side and the defensive side. And quite frankly, I think a lot of people go into it. They learn a little bit about it. I know that I spent 44 years coaching. And the year I finally left, I was flying home on the final game that we lost in the playoffs. And I said to myself, boy, did I learn a lot this year. I think you have to have a thirst for knowledge and continued education. I think you have to become flexible, both about dealing with the personalities of the players. You have to become flexible about the game. I've seen the game change dramatically in 1 year, this year. The rule changes where they said you can't touch anybody anymore outside, change the game. For instance, we used to have a 50-point-per-game score or 47-point-per-game score once every 2 months. We had one every night this year because the rules were changed. So I think to some degree the Pistons this year got caught up in that little bit because they were a club that was developed along another line, a little bit like the clubs I had, execution, and they did all things right because the coaching was terrific. They won 64 games. But there were some of these clubs that had these offensive people outside that were penetrators that were a subject for change in the league. So, and then I think understanding people, because in this day and age, dealing with high-priced athletes, a little bit like, I guess, being a director of a movie. In fact, I used to watch James Lipton every Sunday night inside the actor's studio. I wanted to hear what these actors felt, what these directors felt, because in essence, that's who you are and who you're dealing with, because these people are stars in their own mind. And I talked to a guy the other day, and I said, he asked me, what's the most important thing of any manager, whether it be business or coaching? I said, he's got to make all the people that are working for him or with him think they're better than they are, and then handle the repercussions of that particular problem. Because once they do that, they want all the playing time, they want all the shots, whether good enough to take it from some other member of the team. And so I think all of the team building and the intermingling of handling all of the problems, because I used to say, I did a book one time and with Joe Falls, and I used to say, you know, every player on that club, 12 of them, you have 12-man roster, let's say, they want 48 shots, 48 minutes, and 48 million. Well, now it's 78 million, but everything else is the same. They all want all the minutes and all the shots. Well, you're the guy that's got to take some of that away from them and deal with it, and there's some resentment that builds up in that kind of climate.
Coach Bear Bryant, the famous football coach from Alabama, once said, "If anything goes bad, I did it. If anything goes semi-good, we did it. If anything goes really good, then you did it. That's all it takes to get people to win football games for you." What do you say about that?
Well, I think it's probably as good a quote as you can do about coaching, except it doesn't work that way. It's a great quote, but unfortunately, coaches get upset. They take their players to task. Bruce Arenas they lost their first soccer game, and he took his entire team to task. Now, he might have done it for psychological reasons, and maybe they can handle it. Some people can handle it. You have to know who can handle it and who can't handle it. So I think it's an interesting quote, and if everybody on your team and all the coaches live by this, you'd be successful if you had good personnel.
Your last head coaching job in the NBA was the Orlando Magic, and they paid you $301 a day meal money. Why?
Well, I think the league at that time was $92 per diem for coaches and players. Well, my attorney agent was able to get me $301. And why $1? Because Pat Riley got $300. A little gamesmanship.
So, who has prettier hair, you or Pat Riley?
You know, he's got really great hair because the way he handles it, he gels it, slicks it back, in the manner of some great actors, you know, the Pacinos, the De Niros. Mine's a little wavier, and I'll question his. I'll be 76 in a month from today, and he's 64, so I'll question whether his will hold up to 74.
Johnny Giannopoulos claims that you use Botox up there. Is that true?
No, but I'd like to. I'm ready to use it. If you got anybody, who'll give it to me.
Every club you ever coached, you brought a positive energy to that club. And in this town, we desperately need positive energy. Chuck, how do we get it?
Well, it's going to be a long, hard fight and a drought, because this isn't a problem that's happened overnight. This has been coming on for years and years, and I think, quite frankly, been ignored. I don't know the business community. I don't profess to, but it's been ignored. But I think things like getting the Super Bowl here, Penske was involved, Roger Penske was involved in a lot of things doing that. I think the leaders, the business leaders, all of them, Ford, GM, those are the people that have to resurrect this town. The little guy who has no dollars, working his tail off 80 hours a week to try to survive, I don't know what he can do about it. He can't do any more than he's doing. But I think it has to be the people who are the leaders of the community have access to being able to do that. And it's got to be positive. And they've got to really, and it's going to be a tough, tough job.
Why have you stayed in Michigan half the year?
Well, I come back up here. We have a house here. And my wife is, she really believes this is where we belong. She said, you made it here. These people, well, I can't tell you how people treat me here. In fact, I just left Giannopoulos's about an hour ago. And as I was walking out, there were three guys at the bar, big heavy set guy, said, uh-oh. But the one guy said to me, and he looks much more adult than I thought, he said to me, you know, I worked at the gym over and at the college in Windsor when you guys used to practice over there. He said, I used to be one of the ball guys. And he said, I want to thank you for being so nice to me. And I get that, not because I might have been nice to him, but I get so much of that, the recognition and the love of the people of Detroit for what we accomplished here. And quite frankly, it's a great city, and they're great, great people.
What advice would you give to young people today, Chuck?
Well, the same things their parents are going to say. They're going to talk about education, and they're going to fight you on that. And when they don't have the background and the home to get to that point or get the financial resources or the grades, they're going to fight you on that. You know, I wouldn't really care what anybody does, except I want them to do it with passion. And I think that's the crucial word. If they're going to work at McDonald's, which is wonderful, if they're going to work as a treasurer, a secretary, a line worker at Ford or Chrysler, they're going to coach, they're going to teach, you better have passion. Because quite frankly, I've been around a lot of successful people, almost daily, in fact, have I been around all my lifetime. I've been very fortunate, and there's not one guy or one gal that I met that was successful, didn't have great passion for what they want to do. And I think it's imperative that they find something they're passionate about, and that's the way they're going to be successful.
What dreams and goals do you still have?
Well, I'm trying to stay alive, stay in good health, which is kind of difficult. And for all those people out there smoking and drinking and all of that sort of thing, I haven't been a smoker, but I've had a few drinks in my life. But quite frankly, try to take care of your health, because every day you get older, it gets tougher, and you're waiting for that old next shoe to drop.
Last question. What are you the proudest of?
That I kind of hope that when they put me down and they got a little motto on my gravestone, he said he's a nice guy, because my mother was a nice person, and that's good enough for me, quite frankly.
Chuck Daly, thanks for coming. Jack McCallum wrote in Sports Illustrated once, "The coach with all those suits and all that hair has proved to be a man of style and a man of substance." Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Jack.
Our guest next Sunday will be America's premier personal trainer and the former Mr. Universe, Peter Nielsen. Until then, I'm Jack Krasula. Thanks for listening, and make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spoken.
Believe in yourself. It starts with you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. What else? Believe you. Believe you. It looks like you.